Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. Joining me here at the table is Sarah Donaldson, State House reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Political reporter Haley B. Miller of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome back, Haley.
Good morning.
And Andrew Tobias, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Hey.
Good morning.
Happy April Fool's Day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Before we dive into State House news, I want to take a moment to remember former state lawmaker Bridget Kelly. She lost her battle with cancer last week at age 40. To give you a sense of who she was, Kelly faced a ton of pressure to support Larry Householder for Speaker in 2019. Householder, for those of you who don't remember, worked with Democrats to get the gavel from Republican Ryan Smith. Kelly refused to join Team Householder and lost her position in leadership, as well as support for some of the legislation she was working on. Householder was very much a you're with me or against me kind of guy. And I think it takes real courage to do something you know is going to hurt your career. My mom likes to call it doing the hard right instead of the easy wrong. And I think Bridget Kelly was a great example of that. Here's a clip from one of her last speeches on the Ohio House floor.
So St. Angelo Merici established the Ursuline Order, which was first called the Company of St. Ursula, to teach young girls the Catholic Christian faith. St. Angelo saw women as significant agents of change in a world that was longing for love, unity, and harmony. Throughout high school, we often heard a quote from St. Angelo, and I love this. I think about it every day. Never cease to cultivate this vine that has been entrusted to you. That quote, and what I believe it means, do the most good for the greatest number of people, is something that I've really tried to keep at the center of our work here in the State House.
Andrew, you also got to, I guess, work alongside and report on Bridget Kelly.
Yeah, we were talking about this a little off air. There's a couple of, well, first off, I'll just say that she was one of the nicest people that I've ever covered. And you can kind of see that in the universally positive statements that people have to make about her. But One of the kind of observations I have about this is that I do think that most people who get into politics generally do it for the right reasons, but I've seen instances where some of the best people make the kinds of decisions like Anna described, and you see them often get drummed out of politics. They get kind of fed up with the stuff that happens, and I think that Bridget is an example of that. And, you know, it's sad. And so that's just, you know, I don't have any greater thoughts other than to share than that. But it's unfortunate because you see it happen, and I've seen it happen over the course of my career. And just the other thought that I have is that she became Hamilton County Auditor when she left the State House. And you see instances of talented Democratic lawmakers deciding that they have better opportunities in local government than they do in state government. And so I think that's just something that we can expect to see in the future. But yeah, definitely both those true with her. And again, I think it's really telling that you literally don't hear a single person say a bad thing about her. And I think that's a testament to who she was.
I didn't work as closely with her report on her as much as some of my colleagues in the State House Bureau, but there were a couple different times that I talked to her. And one was just a couple months ago in her capacity as auditor. I called her up and said, "Help, I don't understand property taxes." And she was really gracious and taking some time to talk me through it and all of that at a time when, you know, as we know, at the local level, property taxes have been a huge problem. And I think for Hamilton County residents, having someone like her in that position to explain to not only confused reporters, but confused residents about what was going on must have just been incredibly impactful.
I think it's safe to say that Bridget Kelly will be missed by more than just her friends and family. And now I want to move on to Householder. He's facing new charges from Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost. Andrew, can you explain how these state charges differ from the federal charges that landed him in prison?
So it kind of surrounds similar conduct. And some of the information that led to these charges were things that were actually disclosed through Householder's criminal trial. So for example, state lawmakers are required to fill out ethical disclosure forms that in which they disclose debts that they owe, gifts that they receive. And the prosecution, and honestly, just it had really it wasn't directly related to some of the charges in federal court, but it just came up through the course of cross-examination, through testimony, through evidence that was submitted there. So, for example, Householder, there's a scene in the federal indictment that talked about a very expensive dinner that he had at which there were some undercover FBI agents. Householder never disclosed that dinner and others. It was, you know, established that he had tens of thousands of dollars of credit card debt. Prosecutors in the federal case said that he stole money from his campaign fund basically to pay that back. He never disclosed that in a state ethical forms. And then kind of the centerpiece of the case is Householder, to pay his attorneys in his federal case, took money out of his campaign fund after state officials told him that he shouldn't do that. And prosecutors in the state case say that is a crime itself. It's the core of the case. And what they said when they released the indictment was that the conviction under the charge that they filed because of that theft in office would prohibit him from being in office for the rest of his life if he's convicted, whereas it's possible that the federal case could be appealed and Householder may win. So they said that they're trying to ensure that he never gets back into elected office in the event that he's successful in his federal appeal. But it is related conduct, but it's kind of different charges. And, you know, but like I said, it is stuff that we really only know about because he was charged federally.
Attorney General Dave Yost had this to say, which dovetails perfectly with what Andrew just said.
Even if Mr. Householder's federal appeal is successful, a conviction on state charges in state court for theft in office means the comeback kid will never come back to the General Assembly.
So, Haley, what's next for Householder? I mean, I guess he just awaits this trial now. Could take probably a year-ish.
Yeah, I mean, nothing about the fallout of the House Bill 6 case has moved quickly. Obviously, it took a while for the federal trial to come against him. So at this point, he's going to be fighting on two fronts. He's, you know, fighting through this appeal and dealing with these state charges now. And, you know, I wonder, like, if there was ever a shadow of hope in Householder's head that he could come back to public office if he wasn't, you know, if these state charges hadn't been brought. I can't imagine a scenario in which that would have happened, but it's Ohio politics, so I guess who knows. But these state charges, you know, as you guys have said, is really going to seal the deal and put the nail in that coffin.
And Sarah, Householder is not the only one facing state charges. A couple of weeks ago, the former executives of First Energy were also charged at the state level.
Sure. This kind of federal charges supersede state charges, which is why you kind of saw the federal process work through first. But Attorney General Dave Yost said in general, this is just, you know, moving the accountability process forward. So that's why we're seeing it play out in the way that we are.
Yeah. Andrew, your colleague Jeremy Pelzer had a story Friday that prosecutors allege Sam Randazzo, so he is also somebody who's been charged in this conspiracy, had. So Jeremy says that Randazzo had deals with Duke Energy, General Motors, Marathon Petroleum that were similar to the one that's gotten him into trouble in this particular case.
Yeah, basically, if an electric company wants to raise prices on customers, theoretically, we all and these large companies you're talking about have the same types of rights. But what happens often, and as the charges against Randazzo illustrate, is that the large companies can hire lawyers to fight their own case. They can eventually settle where they agree to drop the lawsuit, you know, challenging the price hike in exchange for just like a lump payout. And what the prosecutors in this case say happened is that Randazzo used that process. There's an interesting message in the indictment, or actually in the bill of particulars, what it's called, which is a document laying out the charges in more detail, that Randazzo specifically said that he and a lawyer for one of those companies that you mentioned talked about keeping their settlement secret, and so they wouldn't discuss it in a way that would be eventually subject to discovery and potentially find its way into the public eye. They specifically, I think Randazzo described it as making sure that the state watchdog consumer agency wouldn't cast it in a bad light or something like that. But they kind of say that that kind of speaks to sort of learning to sort of do these things in secret. And ultimately, Dave Yost and other prosecutors accuse Randazzo of using that process to just pocket some of the money himself. He funneled the payments through an entity that he controlled. And basically, he's accused of skimming some of the settlement money and keeping it in his own pockets.
So we're coming up on the 5-year mark for the introduction of House Bill 6. That's the bill at the center of this scandal. It's the nuclear bailout that a householder was convicted of taking bribes to pass. So the 5-year mark is important because the statute of limitations for many federal crimes is 5 years. So I'm going to ask you guys the really difficult question. Will there be more federal indictments? Don't answer all at once.
Maybe. I don't know that we really have a good answer to that question, right?
It's hard to say, right? Because it also depends on when they deem the 5 years to be up, right? Is it from the introduction? Is it from, you know, this October when they defeated the referendum? Like, it all depends on where you start the clock, right?
Yeah, even locking in that calendar itself has been a conversation in the TV and radio newsroom, because back in December, we were like, are we at the statute of limitations yet or not? So that in of itself is a question.
I personally would be surprised if there aren't more federal charges, just because I think federal prosecutors in Ohio invested a lot of time in this case and have been wanting, excuse me, to send a message about public corruption. But obviously, I'm not psychic. I don't have like an inside scoop about their investigation. That's just kind of my read on it at this point.
I just know that people have been asking forms of that question for years now, and anytime somebody comes forward and has a theory about why this, you know, the charges are definitely coming by the end of this month or something, those dates have come and passed. It's like people predicting the end of the world or something like that. So so it could happen, but it could not happen too. But you know, the other question is, are there going to be more state charges? And I guess we'll have to see what the answer is there as well. But I've kind of taken an attitude as of just kind of sitting back and letting things play out, because a lot of, you know, other stuff, it's just speculation. It's you can't prove or disprove it.
And I think the portion about state charges is interesting, because Attorney General Dave Yost would head those. And I think there are questions about what potential office he's seeking next. So it's not all political, but, you know, it could be some of it.
I mean, it could be justified and political at the same time.
Sure.
And if you're wondering what's been done to prevent another House Bill 6 scandal, we're devoting tomorrow's 10 a.m. show to answering just that question. And spoiler alert, it's not much. So I want to ask, you know, Democrats tried to run on the House Bill 6 scandal in 2020. They tried to bring it back in 22. They had sort of not such great success, at least at the ballot box, in terms of connecting Republicans generally to the scandal specifically. Does it come back again this year?
I thought it was kind of interesting that you saw some Republican legislators using it against each other. I think maybe where you're talking about voters considering multiple candidates that essentially are on the same side of issues that they are, that maybe it could be more of a defining characteristic and something like that. I mean, but that being said, I think the way I view state legislative elections often is that people are thinking about stuff at the top of the ticket. So it's president, it's Senate. And so you could run the greatest campaign ever as a Democrat, and the people in your district like Republicans, and so you get crushed. And you could run a really bad, you know, let's say you're aligned with the voters in your district, and you're on a really bad campaign, but your party is the one that people are sort of favoring. So it's tough to say that it doesn't matter, but that's just kind of, people have wondered about this in the past, and that's been my observation, is that people vote for state legislators on issues that almost are completely unrelated to the things they actually do, which is a bummer, but that's kind of the way I view it.
I think House Bill 6 and the subsequent investigations, it's just so complicated. And so I think if you're trying to distill that into a campaign ad, it's really tough unless you just want to sit there and say Republicans are corrupt. And then if you do that, you sound like about 1,000 other campaign ads that are out there right now. Republicans are corrupt, Democrats are corrupt. I mean, everyone's just kind of wildly accusing each other of that. And it's just a really tough message, I think, to break through all the noise that we're dealing with, especially in 2024.
Unless you are charged with a crime. I mean, voters don't like to vote for people who are, you know, criminals or accused of being it. So, I mean, there are extreme examples, but trying to make the connection can be difficult.
That was Andrew Tobias, a State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Coming up, we're talking about a lawsuit to end Ohio's waiting period for an abortion, plus how the state is preparing for the solar eclipse. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides with Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch up on all the Statehouse news of last week and preview the week ahead. Still with us is Sarah Donaldson, Statehouse reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, political reporter Haley B. Miller of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Andrew Tobias, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. The ACLU and others filed a lawsuit last week to end the 24-hour waiting period to have an abortion. Sarah, what's the legal argument here?
So this is a post-issue one passage in November kind of case, and I think this was to be expected. They argue that the ACLU of Ohio argues that this law provides no health benefit and there's no medical justification for having this waiting period in place. And it just is, again, kind of after issue one passed, the expectation was that some of these what folks see as anti-abortion laws on the books were going to be attacked kind of through the court system, because that's the next step in getting some of these what pro-abortion folks see as anti-abortion laws off the books.
And they are asking for preliminary and permanent injunctive relief. And that essentially means we know it could take years to reach the same Supreme Court, so we want this law taken off immediately.
Yes, the ACLU of Ohio, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it later, their legal team had a very busy week last week, two big filings. And, you know, if they want a preliminary injunction, it's just as the case proceeds. It's kind of, you know, let's put this law on pause while we, you know, kind of hack this out and figure out what the right movement is.
And Haley, that's what's happening with the other legal challenge to the state's heartbeat law. It is on permanent pause.
Right. And I think at least I have been a little surprised that we haven't had a decision by this point. The Supreme Court, I think a couple months ago, I can't remember, time is a blur, but they kicked it back to the Hamilton County Court to make the final decision, essentially. And that court has been friendly to overturning the law, to declaring it unconstitutional, even before issue one went into effect. So I think it's more than likely that that law is going to be off the books any day now, just a matter of when, I guess.
And Andrew, this is all happening in the court because Republicans still have a supermajority in the state house, and they have made it very clear that they are not rolling back any of the abortion laws that they passed.
Yeah, and so what's interesting about this is that this is the first lawsuit that abortion rights activists have brought under since issue one passed and went into effect. And so we've been wondering, you know, because we've talked about this before, but voters might think that they voted to pass issue one, and so that means that suddenly we have more expansive abortion rights in the state. But actually, what the process is going to be, in lieu of the legislators acting like you said, which they don't want to, there's going to be individual lawsuits brought against the 40 some odd abortion restrictions on the books. And so we've been wondering, you know, which ones might they go after, when, like, it's a strategy that goes into it. And so I thought it was interesting that they challenged several state laws at once that kind of combined to form a 24-hour waiting period to obtain an abortion. There's some other laws in the books, too. There's like buckets of them, including parental consent laws. There's the current, I don't remember how many weeks it is, but just the number of weeks after which you can't get an abortion anymore. There's the Down syndrome bill. There's like transfer agreements that hospitals have that basically you have to fulfill certain requirements in order to be able to perform abortions. So all of those are things that they could potentially target. And they picked this one. You know, maybe they think it's the easiest. Maybe they thought that it was the simplest. But yeah, this is just, we're going to be tracking this. And it obviously is, it's just going to be the way that, you know, talking about law stuff is complicated, but it's the way that issue one's actually going to be enforced, and it's incredibly important as a result.
And while in addition to Republicans in the legislature kind of taking a hard line on this, we've seen Attorney General Dave Yost come out and say, I mean, he's going to be the one defending these laws in court. And he has said, even with the 6-week ban, that, you know, maybe it's not a guarantee that this law is going to be declared unconstitutional, even though before the November election, he wrote an opinion that said more than likely it would be declared unconstitutional. You know, I think as Sarah mentioned earlier, he is eyeing another office in 2026. And so some of this may be political, but he definitely, you know, is defending these laws and operating as if they can comply with the new amendment.
And speaking of folks eyeing other offices, this abortion issue will definitely come up during the race for the state Supreme Court, because we actually vote for our state Supreme Court, and we actually have Republican and Democratic designations for these candidates. It's a little bit different than how we do it at the federal level.
It's a little bit different than we did it until about 2 or 3 years ago, too. So Republican lawmakers changed the law to put the party labels on the ballot, and that was a political calculation from them that because it's a Republican-leaning state, and like we were talking about earlier, voters are often thinking about what's at the top of the ticket, not really at the bottom. And so we saw clearly in 2022 that putting Republican and Democratic partisan identifiers in the ballot benefited the Republicans. They went from losing a couple of seats, or 3 seats actually, over the last 6 years to winning all of the ones that were on the ballot last year by about 12 points. So, but yes, it's, you know, we see it's, we're talking about the significance of the court, and that's certainly something that we're going to see in the campaigns for the seats that are up for re-election this year.
And Haley, abortion will also be an issue in the race for U.S. Senate. Most of the Republican candidates have now moved from essentially the heartbeat bill to a 15-week federal ban.
Right. That's the line Bernie Moreno's been giving throughout all of this, even though I think once upon a time he said he didn't support any exceptions. Now he says he supposes what he calls common sense restrictions, which at some point when I bugged him about that, he said that meant like exceptions for rape and incest and that kind of thing. Sherrod Brown campaigned very heavily in favor of issue one. He is pro-abortion access. I mean, he's, you know, very much aligned with the Democratic Party on this issue. So that, I think, is going to be part of the conversation for sure, especially as the debate of a potential federal ban is out there. Now, there's a lot of other stuff going on in the Senate race. So whether abortion is the top, I don't know if abortion will be the top issue, but it'll be up there.
And speaking of lawsuits, a couple of different groups, including the ACLU, as Sarah mentioned, have gotten together to challenge the constitutionality of the state's new law restricting hormones and puberty blockers for transgender minors. It also bans transgender girls from playing on female sports teams. So, Sarah, what are the groups seeking here?
Yeah, so similar to the lawsuit against the 24-hour waiting periods, although those laws are already on the books, we're about a month from, actually we're less than a month because it's now April, as I'm remembering. We are less than a month from when House Bill 68 takes effect. So that's the bill you were talking about. And they would like to see that bill blocked from going into effect on schedule and at all. They're arguing both that it's discriminatory under the Ohio Constitution, and they're also arguing that it doesn't follow single subject rule, which is, you know, kind of a rule that exists for legislation. Bills technically aren't supposed to be about more than one subject. Obviously, as we all know, that's not always the case. I believe the sports gambling law was passed in like a veterans ID bill. So it's that one's definitely a tough argument. But they're arguing because this bill, if you all remember, was at one time two separate bills. It was a bill banning gender-affirming care for minors, and it was also a bill banning trans girls from playing in youth athletics on teams that align with their gender identity. So they're also arguing on that portion, but it's also in the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas. Law goes into effect at the end of the month, so we'll have to see. I checked Friday. I don't know if anyone's checked the court website. I don't know that there's a hearing yet scheduled on that, but
Haley, I have a process question for you, because schools, there is no direction in the law. If House Bill 68 becomes law, if there's not a temporary injunction, there's no real direction on how to verify whether a student is transgender. If I'm remembering that correctly, there's nothing in the bill about it. So how are schools thinking about this possibly going into effect? Because they could have a legal liability.
Right. So the legal liability I think you're referring to is the part of the bill that says if parents or children, their families believe that they've lost an opportunity because of a transgender athlete, they can sue. So at one point, this bill had a really controversial way of verifying a child's
medical examinations.
Yes. That got scrapped because that just faced immense blowback. And so at this point, I think, you know, last time I checked with like schools and the Ohio, you know, High School Athletics Association, it was still kind of TBD. You know, I think they're going to have a tough time figuring out how to establish a uniform process without any real guidance under the legislation. So I do feel like the legislature kind of left them hanging when it comes to that.
Yeah, something we could see here, though, you know, we were talking about the heartbeat bill a few minutes ago. And again, like, time is a blur for me, too. I think the lawsuit was filed in 2021 challenging that. Was it 2022? Whatever year it was after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. I mean, that's been on hold for 2 years or more. And so there's definitely been efforts by state lawyers to move that case out of the Democratic-leaning jurisdiction in Hamilton County to the state Supreme Court, which is Republican-leaning. And they were unsuccessful at doing that. And in the interim period, we passed a ballot issue on it. So in this case, we very well could see the transgender bill basically just being on indefinite hold for years in Franklin County while this kind of these legal processes play out. And maybe part of the strategy is that maybe the political winds change in the intervening time, that sort of thing. But some of the actual practical questions like might kind of boil down to, we won't know because this law might be on hold for the indefinite future.
And going back to your question about the schools, Anna, part of me wonders if they, I mean, I don't think the ACLU, any of these groups that were opposed to House Bill 68 were shy about the fact that they planned to sue. So maybe that was part of the consideration as well. Like, you know, maybe we just won't have to deal with this on April 24th.
Other courts in other states have put similar laws on hold. So they may be banking on that.
It's a little bit of a mixed bag, though. I mean, some courts have upheld the laws and others have put them, I mean, a lot of them have put them on hold as the court has worked through. But it is a mixed bag when it comes to final decisions on these laws.
So next Monday, a large swath of Ohio will plunge into darkness in the middle of the afternoon. And traffic is going to be, well, it's going to be pretty bad. So how is the state preparing for the solar eclipse? Or perhaps not preparing?
Well, I mean, for one, there are like $1 million in the state budget for the eclipse that is going to the Department of Public Safety. So that's going to be, I believe, emergency reimbursements to agencies. So if agencies incur some sort of a cost because of some sort of eclipse-related response they have to have on day of, they can file for
traffic accidents, sure, extra payroll.
So that was passed, you know, when the operating budget was passed, and that's one, you know, definitive thing for me that I've been kind of working on this week.
ODOT has told me that they're basically treating the eclipse like a major travel holiday times about 1,000. So just expect a lot of, you know, more folks out on the road making sure that things are going smoothly. I know ODOT also created this map that is forecasting what traffic might look like in certain areas, and they're hoping emergency responders are using that to figure out if they need to deploy more resources to certain areas like I-75 around Dayton and Cincinnati and that kind of thing. I know like emergency management has done drills basically preparing for different scenarios. So they very much are, you know, preparing for this. And definitely the state tourism arm is also urging people to spend as much time in Ohio as they possibly can and after the eclipse.
Yeah, I feel like it's a combo of like everyone be prepared, but also everyone come to Ohio and spend your dollars in our state.
Yeah, I definitely recommend fueling up the car, having that cell phone charger, and probably packing a couple of extra snacks. That seems like a safe minimum amount of prep.
Sure.
And my favorite actual story to come out of this so far is the merging of the politics and the solar eclipse, because there's a county GOP organization who is making money off Trump eclipse glasses.
Happy 2024.
So, and for those who listen to the Reporter Roundtable regularly here, we're not having one next Monday. We're going to devote the 10 a.m. hour to the eclipse. And we want to hear from you. You can call or email All Sides at WOSU.org with how you're planning to see the eclipse. How are you guys planning to see the eclipse?
So I feel like there's different archetypes of people for this. And so I'm of the archetype that I at least know it's coming. So I've checked that box. I feel proud of that, you know, so I'm not totally flat-footed on it. But I ordered my eclipse glasses today on Amazon after sort of having a general notion that I might try to pick them up from my local library. So I don't really have a plan. My kids' daycare is closed that day. I'm certainly not going to be, if I'm not officially off work, I'm not going to be working very well. But we also do have kind of like an early release happening at work too. So essentially, we're just going to be watching it at my house. And so I'm not going to be in the zone of totality. It's, you know, a bummer that I live probably 5 miles from a geographic event that occurs once every 200 years. And I can't really figure out how I'm going to get there, but that's okay. So that's my plan. I did buy the glasses at least. And I think seeing the mostly total eclipse should be fine.
Andrew and I kind of fall in the same camp, but I will probably be on Cap Square at the Ohio State House, and I may step out of the totally dark basement, which is basically like living in an eclipse at all times because there's no sunlight, and I will probably step outside and watch it from there. But I did get my glasses from the library.
That was a great way to market the basement of the State House, by the way. You should work in tourism or something like that.
Yeah, sorry to anyone at the State House who heard that.
I will be driving up to totality about an hour or so to the Ohio Caverns. At least that's the plan at this point, and hoping that I'm not in traffic forever, ever. But at this point, I've written a couple stories about how the state is preparing for eclipse traffic. So I feel like if anyone should be prepared, it's probably me.
I hope you are. My house is actually in the path, but it's only got like 15 seconds. So we're actually going an hour further north so we can get the full 3 minutes, and we'll probably be there all day. So Amy Jurevich will be hosting the Eclipse Hour next Monday. And coming up, are pharmacies that sell painkillers a public nuisance? The Ohio Supreme Court is mulling the issue. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. It's our weekly Reporter Roundtable, where we catch you up on all the State House news. Still with us is Sarah Donaldson, State House reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, political reporter Haley B. Miller of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Andrew Tobias, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. So the Ohio Supreme Court heard oral arguments last week about whether pharmacies distributing legal painkillers create a public nuisance. That is a little strange. Sarah, what's going on here?
Yeah, I will forewarn this one is a little bit technical, but basically, obviously, the opioid epidemic has hit Ohio in as it's hit many other states throughout the country. And recently, lawyers for county governments and municipalities have been bringing forth lawsuits in Ohio and across the country against drug distributors, pharmacies, and drug makers. And they're arguing that their process for how they make and distribute drugs kind of contributed to the opioid epidemic, and it thus created a public nuisance because of the after effects of what has happened with the opioid epidemic. So Trumbull, and I want to check which other Ohio county because I'm blanking. But
Lake.
Thank you so much. So Trumbull
I
and Lake.
I have notes. It helps.
Thank you. So Trumbull and Lake counties won a lawsuit in a district trial court like 2 years ago, and they were owed $650 million in abatement payouts for this same argument. You know, they were arguing that these drug makers and these drug distributors created a public nuisance. So they have to pay out $650 million. And that money, because it's public nuisance lawsuits are very specific, the money would go toward, you know, treatment plans and a lot. It would have to go to specific remedies for the opioid epidemic in those two counties. So the defendants, the pharmacies and whatnot, they're appealing. It was working through federal district court. And one of the questions in the appeal is, does Ohio state law actually permit this lawsuit under a public nuisance claim? So that's why it's in front of the Ohio Supreme Court. The pharmacies specifically are arguing, you know, this doesn't create a public nuisance. A public nuisance is, you know, loud noises or bright lights or, you know, bad smells from pollution that affect everyone. This should be under a product liability claim. But public nuisance lawsuits have kind of cropped up more recently because of how these remedies are offered. That's why more and more public nuisance lawsuits are being filed. So, like I said, very, very technical, but it's an interesting question in front of the Ohio Supreme Court right now. And once the Ohio Supreme Court makes a decision, that will kind of determine what happens with the federal lawsuit and whether these two counties will actually be awarded the $650 million payout.
Well, for being wonky, you did an excellent job. So I don't think I have any other questions. I think you covered it. Yeah. So let's move on to an election update. So Republican lawmakers want to change Ohio's voter registration forms to prompt voters to list their most recent previous address explicitly. Why?
Yeah, so this is something that it's very early on, and so there hasn't been a Legislative Service Commission analysis, which is the nonpartisan research arm of the state. So I know that there is a portion of the form that that voters can use that has this already, but as I kind of view this, it would make it more prominent. It might require it as opposed to it being administratively included at this point. But the why part is that I think fundamentally that Republican legislators have, you know, are hearing from their voters that there's something wrong with how the voting process works. Of course, this is because Donald Trump said that he lost the 2020 election because it was stolen from him, which has not been found false in a number of ways, you know, or best unsupported. But they're trying to say that, you know, it's possible in Ohio, like, so I don't know if anybody else has this experience, but when I have moved, I don't actually recall canceling my old voter registration. You're basically registered to vote in two places at once. And the idea behind this law is that it would make it easier where if you were to put your previous address, it also would include an administrative process through which it would require that the state or the elections officials inform the elections officials in your old county. And so, without getting into the weeds, there are processes that exist now that ensure that from would happen, but maybe the way that this would change that would make it more efficient or easier. But the bottom line is that, you know, Republican legislators who sponsored this have concerns about whether it's the process that exists currently is it's too easy for you to be registered to vote in multiple places. And so they want to change that and, you know, make it less likely that's the case.
And Andrew can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there's another part of the bill, too, where it would list the penalties for voter fraud in a clearer place and very loud caps lock, if I remember the bill text correctly. So that's just another example of how they're really trying to crack down on this stuff.
But what the sponsor told me was that his son moved to Tennessee temporarily, and while he was there, he remained registered to vote in Ohio. And so I believe, presumably, he moved back and found that he was still on. But so a form of voter fraud that's relatively easy to detect is if somebody does try to vote in multiple locations at the same time, ultimately, computer checks are performed to basically ensure that people don't do that. So they are able to, you know, generally uncover that. So it's actually, if somebody were to try to commit voter fraud, this would be a really bad way to do it because you're putting your name into a computer database, essentially, even though There have been changes that have been made recently that make it harder to do that. But regardless.
And I was going to say, it's not very common to have a person vote in two different counties.
No, it's...
with the current system.
There are probably maybe less than 10 people who have done this in the last 10 years or something like that. So it's incredibly rare.
And Republicans aren't the only one who want to change some of how we get on the ballot or vote. Democrats want to exempt candidates who get a court-ordered name change and publicize the prior name. It's basically actually, Haley, I'm just going to let you explain this.
Yeah. So with some of the state house races this year, we've seen problems with transgender candidates wanting to run under their current name, and state law requires them to list all of their previous names, which includes what transgender folks refer to as their dead name. And this law would basically carve out an exemption for them so that transgender candidates would not have to do that. And, you know, there are at least three on the ballot this year that I'm aware of. And, you know, worth noting that I think we're seeing more of that because of legislation like House Bill 68 and some of the other efforts to restrict transgender rights in the state house. So this is an effort by Democrats to curb that. And Governor Mike DeWine has said that this is something the state should deal with too. Whether Republican lawmakers are on board with this, I guess we'll find out. I would be shocked if it's a priority for them, but.
Yeah, and there is, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, there is an exemption already for people who get married. So, like, you can have a marriage name change and not have to disclose that.
Yeah, there was an instance in Stark County, apparently, where a woman who's running for judge changed her name to reflect, I guess, you know, her longtime partner's last name, and she ended up getting disqualified because she didn't meet that exemption that you described. But it's just interesting that we had three or four candidates in this current election cycle filed a run. We had one of them rejected and three of them made it through, basically in different counties but under more or less identical circumstances. And so if nothing else, we have, you know, an inconsistent way the law is being enforced, and so you'd think that lawmakers would want to address that,
or at the very least the court's going to take a look at it, since when you have unequal application of the law, that tends to kick up a court case pretty quick.
I've always thought this would be really ripe for a lawsuit. I'm surprised we haven't seen one yet.
One thing that Republicans are talking about, which I find interesting, is term limits. So Senate President Matt Huffman last week argued that changes to Ohio's term limits might be a good idea. And even though the two men don't see eye to eye on a lot of issues, House Speaker Jason Stevens floated the idea last December. So it sounds like they're at least considering the idea.
I think they're I would call it pondering, I guess.
Yeah, pontificating on it.
Yeah. Speaker Stevens brought it up at a brown bag lunch with reporters, and most of it was pretty standard stuff, but then he brought up term limits, and I remember everyone kind of looking at each other. We were like, oh, this is new, this is newsy. But I mean, you definitely, it's kind of a double-edged sword with term limits, because I think every time politicians bring them up, it's something that, you know, the average person is probably for term limits, even if they don't think about the issue a ton. It's an issue that, you know, is not something everyone's like, let's get rid of term limits. But I don't know.
They would have to create an amendment, right? And then send it to voters. And that feels like a heavy lift. Even like, yeah.
But the thing I find interesting about term limits in Ohio is that it feels like we only kind of have term limits because... And this is a little in the weeds.
There's a lot of chamber swapping.
Right. So a lawmaker will be term limited in the House and then decide to run for Senate and vice versa. I mean, that's what Senate President Matt Huffman is doing. He's running for a House seat because he's term limited in the Senate. So I don't know. I find the conversation interesting. And, you know, maybe the idea is to prevent some of that chamber swapping and have more meaningful term limits. But it's a complicated issue because people who oppose term limits say that, you know, you're really losing institutional knowledge when you kind of cut people off after a certain time.
Yeah, and I think the well on this is poisoned a little bit, because right before Larry Householder was arrested in the House Bill 6 scandal, he was we all kind of suspected at the time, but subsequently have definitively found out that he was trying to engineer a term limits amendment that would set a hard number of years cap on how long somebody could serve to address the issue that Haley just described. But the way that he was pursuing it would have allowed Householder to basically reset his term limit clock at zero and allow him to remain speaker until the late 2030s instead of facing being termed out in the mid, you know, around now, had he not been arrested. So they were going to sell it in that case as term limits are broken the way that they work. We're going to make tougher term limits. And they kind of had this like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, application about how to affect individual lawmakers. And so now, you know, somebody would have to kind of come up with something that's sort of similarly politically slick like that to get over the fact that term limits fundamentally sound good to voters, and that's why they approved them in the first place. And when we can't see the two chambers in the legislature agreeing on basic stuff, coming up with like a strategy to do something like that's politically complicated, they're gonna have to find money to pay for it. You know, it just doesn't seem like, it kind of seems like a long shot.
Right now it feels very preliminary. It's just, you know, like we said, kind of pondering. It's floating. It's out there. You know, I've heard both Democratic and Republican lawmakers float it a little bit, but there's no real guardrails yet.
And I would be curious how an amendment over term limits would fare right now, because I do think voters generally support term limits. And I think because of some things we've seen in Congress lately, it's really at the front of people's minds, because we just have folks who've been there for a really long time. Dianne Feinstein passed away in office. So I think the debate is alive and well in Washington, and that could trickle down.
Yeah, Bernie Marino's running on term limits. It's like one of the core features of his campaign, I would say.
But one thing we won't see on the ballot probably this fall is a dealing with qualified immunity. So that's the protection that law enforcement has when, say, they fire a weapon while on duty. So the Ohio Supreme Court has declined to fast track a lawsuit from a group that's trying to force Attorney General Dave Yost to let them move forward with a ballot issue to repeal what's known as qualified immunity. Oh, this is another, I feel like everything today is like, well, this is complicated and technical, but it is important. So who wants to take a, I'm not going to say stab at trying to explain this one.
The law itself or the process?
What's going on with this ballot initiative?
So in order to get an amendment on the state, on the ballot, you have to get 411 or 412,000 voter signatures, and you have to collect twice as much practically or so to make sure that people are not, you know, erroneously, you know, signing the form who aren't qualified. And that's very expensive. It's very time consuming. So I will say that I don't think that this particular campaign group, I haven't seen any evidence that they have the resources that it would require in order to do that. But that being said, they can't even collect the signatures, because when you pass around the petitions to get those signatures, you have to have language on there that explains what your amendment would do. And Dave Yost's office has to sign off on that language. It's stuck there before him. He's raised a number of issues, including, I think the title of it is Protecting Ohioans' Constitutional Rights or something, which he's not for protecting constitutional rights, right? Like,
they always have great names.
Yeah. And Yost has taken kind of a stand on that recently, saying that these flowery titles are bad, even though his office has approved them previously. And so, but now that they're stuck and they can't get past him, they've tried to sue in a couple of different ways, and we'll see whether or not that does anything. But they have until July to collect these signatures, and it's April now.
And they haven't even started.
Right. So it's not going to happen. But it is an interesting question, because this ballot title thing has come up with something else that would change voting rights laws, and it's something that's going to affect any number of these amendments that come up in the future. So, but yeah, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, it's definitely a process issue of how things actually get before us as voters. And they can keep trying. I mean, I guess if they go past July, they'd be looking at November 2025 at the earliest.
I said this last week, but I think that this has spanned every election cycle that I have been a reporter in Columbus, because they have been trying this not just for this election cycle.
Yeah, I think they've been rejected 6 or 7 times or something like that. But yeah, you did hear about these people, though, because when issue one last August was happening, which would have, had it passed, made it harder to amend the Constitution, you had Republican opponents saying, look at these people. They want to, you know, make it easier to sue police, and kind of as an example of how, you know, left wing the you know, the issue was the other side or whatever. So these people have been in the background. But again, I've never seen any evidence that they really have the resources that it would take to get something like on the ballot because it's very hard. It's not easy to do.
That was Andrew Tobias, a State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks to Sarah Donaldson, State House reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Thank you.
And Haley B. Miller, political reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau.
Always a pleasure.
And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.